Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions with the support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for joining us. As Kentucky school districts sort out a way forward under pandemic conditions, one thing seems certain. Most will require students to wear masks. So what does that mean? What are the effects of covering the mouth at such a crucial time for cognitive development? We have a pair of perspectives. On the line with us now is Dr. Jade Robinson from EKU's Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders. Dr. Robinson has 20 years of professional experience serving young children and their families, and we want to learn from her what wearing masks in class is going to mean to students this fall. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Robinson.
Thank you so much.
So what do we know from research about the significance of facial expression on early language development?
Right. So the significance of facial expression on early language development is well established. We know that babies are naturally drawn to look at the human face, and that really goes across the age span for children. Babies, toddlers, school-age children are going to look toward the human face for cues and for language information. Dr. Amy Weatherby and colleagues with the First Words Project provide a series of social communication growth charts on their website called Baby Navigator. And the growth chart for 1 to 2 month olds shows that even these very young babies are looking at your face when they're being held and will smile in response to an adult smile. And also, we've known for decades, really, that facial cues and interaction with another person are critically important. So even in 1975, this was being investigated. So Dr. Ed Tronick and colleagues first presented the steel face experiment, and during their experiment, they engaged infants with a non-responsive and expressionless adult, and after failed attempts to interact with the adult multiple times, the babies tended to withdraw and turn their faces away from the adult. So this steel face study has been replicated with various ages and populations with very similar results. Another thing to consider with language development is the fact that children use visual cues and imitation to learn how to produce speech sounds. So when I say a word like mama, the child is looking at my lips as I put my lips together to produce that m sound. Another thing that we also need to think about is that young children may not have the ability to repair a communication breakdown. So when they don't understand maybe what someone has said, because it is more difficult to hear someone when they're wearing a mask, a young child may not have that ability to say, would you repeat yourself or say that again? So the child may seem unresponsive to the person's question or direction, which obviously is going to cause a problem in the classroom. So the bottom line is facial expressions and cues enhance social interactions and child language development in numerous ways. So we need to think more about that for sure.
Well, for younger students, learning to read is one of the most important goals of being in school. So how do facial cues help children learn to read?
Right. So as children develop their reading skills, they are learning that the sounds of our language are represented by letters. And we often teach children letter-sound correspondence based on how sounds are produced. For example, the letters P and B are lip popper sounds because we put the lips together and pop them open to say pa and ba. So once children learn that the letter P makes the pa sound, they can begin to sound out words like puppy or pie. In this type of instruction, the visual model of sound production is extremely important.
Is there any research yet about how masks might impact kids with language delays or disorders?
I'm not aware of any research directly investigating this specific question in terms of language development. I was able to find one 2005 article on the impact of wearing a face mask during an oral examination for grade 11 students. The study was conducted in Hong Kong as a result of students wearing masks due to the severe acute respiratory syndrome or SARS crisis. And although the students performed well while wearing a mask, this study did not research the effects of communication partners wearing masks during critical periods of language development. I do know that children rely on multiple sources of input to understand and learn the language spoken to them. And without being able to see a person's full face, they may have more difficulty comprehending a person's intent and reading social cues. So learning to interpret emotion and language is especially important for children with autism or other social communication delays, as they may have more difficulty with these skills even without masks. And individuals with hearing loss often benefit from lip reading and seeing the exaggerated expressions used by communicators who use sign language. So masks are not likely to prevent language development, but they may make it more challenging for some children.
What can adults who need to wear a face mask, what can they do to help children while communicating with them?
Well, thankfully, it's a non-issue for parents or family members who are not likely to wear masks at home. But this is incredibly important for child care providers, educators, medical providers, and any other adult who would interact regularly with children. So we do need to think about some innovative things that we can do. I really like the mask with the clear window insert. The cutout mask with the transparent insert will cover the nose and mouth better than a face shield, but still allow the communication partners to see the mouth. And even as early as February of this year, an EKU senior, Ashley Lawrence, started sewing face masks with clear inserts. So we've definitely seen the benefits of some creative individuals. Another suggestion would be to use more gestures in conjunction with your spoken words to help children understand your message better. And also, since your emotions aren't as visible when wearing a mask, talk about your emotions more openly and often. For example, instead of just smiling when you greet a child, maybe say, "I'm so happy to see you," to really emphasize your emotion. And for educators working on literacy instruction, they could consider supplementing instruction with up-close videos of speakers producing the target sounds so the children have a visual model for sound production. And for healthcare providers, I've seen something really innovative. Consider wearing a photo button that shows your smiling face, because children are going to be naturally curious and probably want to know what you look like under your mask. I've even seen where healthcare providers are taping laminated photos of themselves to their protective gowns so that patients can see a smiling face, which I think is great. And finally, for parents and families, give your children lots of face-to-face time at home so that they benefit from the social interaction and language modeling that you can provide without a mask possibly interfering.
Well, Dr. Robinson, we're in a situation that we hope will pass at some point and life will return to some sort of normalcy, although it's pretty sure that it's going to be different no matter what. But in the meantime, many of these children are in development stages, and that can't be prolonged. And I'm just wondering, are we going to end up with a generation of young people who are really good at reading eyebrows and hand gestures, perhaps better so than we are?
Right. I think that's an important point is, you know, humans are very adaptable, and children are going to learn to communicate effectively, I think, in maybe different ways. So I've heard people talk about smiling with your eyes now instead of smiling with your mouth, or you would actually be doing both. But to really emphasize the eyes and eyebrows and upper part of the face even more so than we maybe do under normal circumstances. So I think children will adapt and they will become effective communicators in other ways perhaps. And, you know, facial coverings are used in other cultures, and I think we could probably learn from how those children develop as well.
Dr. Jade Robinson, she's from EKU's Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders. Thank you so much, Dr. Robinson.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
One group of people who really need to be able to see facial expressions are those who can't hear. Katie Moore is a new faculty member with the American Sign Language and Interpreter Education Department at Eastern Kentucky University. She's been teaching ASL for 6 years, both at the high school and college levels. Katie was born hearing, and at about 3.5 years old, her parents discovered that she wasn't hearing things. So they took her for a hearing test, and it was found that she had a hearing loss. She wore hearing aids for a time and learned sign language, but over time her hearing diminished. She's now deaf and uses American Sign Language, or ASL, to communicate. My questions for Katie are being interpreted and signed for her by her department chair, Vicki Brashear, who's also voicing Katie's responses for us. And they are Zooming while we talk. Thank you, Dr. Brashear, and thanks for joining us, Katie.
Thank you for inviting me to do this interview.
Okay, and first question, we're talking about face masks. How do they impact you as a deaf or hard of hearing person?
Well, so with those masks, it's really hard because it blocks the mouth and we can't see the mouth. And typically, most people, when they use those masks, we can't see any lip movement. Now, if I'm out and about in town, you know, with the general public, and they're using masks, I can't communicate well because traditionally I try to lip read. And if I try to communicate typically with lip reading, it does help me to understand somewhat and I can communicate. But with these face masks, I'm not able to see their lips. So I don't have a way to communicate. So I have to find pencil and paper or use my phone and text, you know, back and forth to the person. So I find alternate ways to communicate with those people.
You've mentioned that as an example of what you're dealing with, a recent trip to Dollar General. Could you tell us what happened?
Well, I went in to purchase some items, and then I was getting ready to check out, and I had cash on me. And when I looked at the register, I saw how much it was, and I got that amount of money and gave to the person, and I was waiting for them to give me my change back and my receipt, and I was looking around, and the person kept looking at me, and I was just patiently waiting. And finally, I said, is there something wrong? And apparently the cash register display was wrong, but it was so awkward for me because she was waiting for me to give her more money, and there was no way for me to see that she was actually speaking to me because of the mask. And so it was a really awkward and embarrassing moment. And, you know, that was just a daily thing of going to a little Dollar General store. And that experience there kind of impacted me on the impact that this is all having.
Mm-hmm. What are you missing out on even when you're communicating in ASL with other deaf people?
Well, a lot. Well, you know, COVID right now just really has impacted the deaf culture and deaf people. I'll start with culture. Now, deaf individuals typically are very friendly, very, you know, touchy-feely kind of people. And, you know, when we say hello, we hug each other. And when we leave, we hug each other. We want that personal contact. That's our thing that's involved with our culture. But now, when we get close to each other, you know, you typically have to touch the elbows or whatever. You know, that's how people are doing it. But also, the way we get somebody's attention is to tap them on their shoulder. So now we can't even do that. So that's very awkward for the deaf community right now.
We've heard it suggested that clear masks might be a good thing in the classroom for young children so that they can at least see some expression. And I'm wondering about that in your case. What about these clear masks to be able to see lips move?
Honestly, Tom, with those clear masks, it depends because a lot of people have tried and tested those. And, you know, ASL teachers are actually working together trying to figure out the best solution for us with this situation. However, the price may be a little more expensive for a specific type of clear masking that you could see the lips. And could students afford those? And, you know, who's responsible to pay for that additional cost? Another issue could be, are there enough made for all the ASL students across the United States? Who knows? You know, there are a lot of schools that have ASL programs, either in the high school or at the college level, and that's going to mean that there's going to be a lot of those masks necessary. So we don't even know that they would be able to meet the numbers there. Another issue would be the glare. you know, sometimes when you go to a person that might have, you know, glasses and you notice a glare from a light or something and you can't really see clear, it's similar with that clear mask. So you can't really see the mouth movement due to the glare. Lastly, you know, when we breathe, the respiration comes out on the mask and kind of fogs it up. And there is another issue. You won't be able to see the lips. So right now, people are really trying to figure out the best way. And there are some options, but there's not a lot of options for masking.
Let's talk a little bit about Zoom. And for anybody who just joined us, we're talking with Katie Moore. She's a new faculty member with the American Sign Language and Interpreter Education Department at EKU. And she and the department chair, Vicki Brashear, are communicating at this moment via Zoom. And the voice that you're hearing in response to my questions is Vicki, who is interpreting Katie's signing. So let's talk about Zoom a little bit. What are some problems with using Zoom?
You know, Zoom, if you use it with a small number of people, it works okay. You know, right now you and I are speaking and it's perfect. But let's say, you know, sometimes, you know, internet connections are not good, and so therefore you would lose that. That would be one obvious issue. But if you're talking about a classroom and teaching online using Zoom, that's very different. You might have 2D versus 3D. So students are learning a visual language, and in person, they see the signing, they see all the different dimensions, the movements, how the body is moving, and so forth. So you see everything. But with the Zoom and 2D, it's almost like looking at a book. You can't really see any of the movement. And so, you know, obviously Zoom is better than a book, of course, but it's still not the complete picture of how the language is used. And also, Tom, one thing that I've noticed is, you know, if I'm teaching my class, and I have all the students portrayed up on my screen. Typically, whoever actually speaks, their tile opens up and is big. And if you're signing and don't actually use your voice, we have to figure out a way to make that person who is signing to come up as the bigger tile. So like I would be teaching and all the students would be able to see me and sign. But if I wanted to then a student to take over and maybe take turns with each other, somebody's going to have to monitor that session and watch who's signing and watch whose turn it is next to sign and make their picture or their tile bigger. Because if the smaller ones, it'd be really difficult to see the movement of someone using sign language. Typically, you know, turn-taking happens in ASL, and typically there are a lot of different things that we can notice during a conversation for turn-taking that show that it's, I have finished, and it's now your turn to take over the conversation. But in Zoom, we miss that dimension.
This is so interesting. Another aspect of our rapidly increasing can't live with it, can't live without it relationship with Zoom. How does social distancing that we're dealing with and Zoom, which of course is not in the same room with people, how does that challenge deaf people who are used to a certain deaf culture?
People are going to have to understand that when you're learning ASL, you're not just learning the language, you're also learning all the cultural aspects as well. So many people don't realize that everyone is included. You know, you have the deaf culture and hearing culture. And some people don't realize that in deaf culture, we do have our deaf culture. And as you teach students and they can see things in person, they see, you know, there's more of a comfort level and that, you know, how we talked about the hugging or embracing. And it's hard for students to learn that through Zoom, and it's hard to show that. Plus, I'm a deaf instructor, and I truly enjoy being in person with the students and engaging with them and getting to know them much better and the socialization with them. And on Zoom, it's a disconnect. You see a screen, and I feel like I'm talking to a screen, not to or with students. So it makes it that much more awkward.
The governor, since he has been holding the daily briefings on the coronavirus situation, has always had usually Virginia Moore there doing signing. And he has even taken to learning signing during the briefing. That must be a little heartening to see that going on. What do you think?
I think it's amazing. I think that's so wonderful. Now, I just did move to Kentucky, and I came from a different state. And I notice now that a lot of governors are starting to utilize the sign language interpreter in their briefings. So I can't explain how much I really appreciate that, because if I were to be watching on Facebook or any other social media, the captioning doesn't always work on those devices, and I don't have cable TV, so how am I going to access that? So it works out perfectly that I can watch the governor and watch the interpreter, and I miss no information. And I think it's awesome. I truly do. That's a big step for a governor, plus everybody who's watching him every day on TV and thought, well, the governor's learning sign language. Maybe that will impact other people to learn sign language. And so that will show that more people are really trying to want to communicate with deaf individuals. And that is so important. We do want to be able to communicate with other people. We want other people to learn our language and learn what we do. So that's why we teach it. That's why we value our culture and the language. And we want to share it with the world.
All right. Katie Moore is a faculty member with the American Sign Language and Interpreter Education Department at Eastern Kentucky University. Thanks, Katie. And again, our thanks for her assistance to Department Chair Vicki Brashear, whose voice you've been hearing. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me to join in on this interview. I really do appreciate it, Tom.
A recent study by the American Association of School Administrators says reopening an average-sized district will cost about $1.8 million extra dollars, and that, says the state's Associate Education Commissioner Robin Kinney, is the best-case scenario. In an interview with WKYT, Kinney said, in that survey, they talk about ensuring that there is a nurse in every school building, and in Kentucky, we just don't have that. It also talked about monitors for every school bus, and we don't have the money for that. Governor Beshear has said that if the state doesn't get more federal help, Kentucky is facing a budget shortfall in the next fiscal year of just over $1 billion. The state is prohibited from running a deficit, so a shortfall means cutting services and programs. So it's likely that at least part of that shortfall will be felt in the classroom. Coming up after the break, the challenge of providing an accurate historical record of life lived in chattel slavery.
We don't have those kinds of textual documents that historians often rely on to tell these stories.
And
it's interesting to note that the word loneliness is almost unique to English.
Tom Eblin's conversation with Fenton Johnson, author of At the Center of All Beauty, Solitude and the Creative Life. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Documenting the history of enslaved people is quite a challenge. So little reliably accurate documentation is available to historians. But accounts must be chronicled if we are ever to fully comprehend our country's experience with race. It's a focus for Carol Emberton, a Kentucky-born associate professor of history at the University of Buffalo. Her fields of interest include 19th century U.S. history, Civil War and Reconstruction, Southern history, African-American history, and the history of slavery and emancipation. Dr. Emberton joins us to talk about another of her interests, historical memory. Greetings, Carol.
Hi, Tom.
So let me ask you first, what set you on this course to investigate the difficulty of constructing an accurate historical record of enslaved African Americans?
Well, I'm a historian of sort of the Civil War era. So broadly, sort of this, long period in the 19th century that encompasses the rise of the sectional conflict over slavery, the Civil War itself, and then really sort of the aftermath of the war. And so the thing I'm particularly interested in is trying to recreate that really tumultuous time and those, unprecedented experiences, but I'm particularly interested in trying to do so from the perspective of enslaved and formerly enslaved people themselves, right? So we have lots of sources, government documents and newspapers and diaries and letters from white people, politicians, soldiers, who were all, recording their experiences and their perspectives on what the country was going through and what they personally were going through. But there are far less documents, firsthand documents, created by and written by African-American peoples themselves. And I'm not here to say that there are none. There are. But particularly if you're focusing on people who were enslaved, who were mostly illiterate, had never learned to read or write, and had no access, to the kind of things you would need to create documents, paper, pencils, places to store them and keep them. We don't have those kinds of textual documents that historians often rely on to tell these stories. So that's the kind of limitations that I'm dealing with in terms of what the archive, the historical archive, the record that exists for these people in trying to piece together their stories.
In your article for the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, the article titled Searching for Caroline, Disciplined Imagination and the Limits of the Archive, you point this out, the challenge of trying to produce a history of people who left behind very little documentation of their lives. So I'm wondering, how does a writer of history looking for factual accuracy go about chronicling those lives?
Well, I think what you have to do is to cast a really wide net. and you have to look high and low for different kinds of sources that might give you some kind of detail or perspective that you wouldn't get otherwise. So sometimes historians we have kind of our favorite sources that we like to use a lot. And you can see when you look at, particular people's books, they really rely heavily maybe on, letters and diaries, or they rely heavily on newspaper accounts or published government documents. We generally tend to sort of gravitate towards our favorite kinds of sources. But when you're writing these kinds of histories and wanting to recreate these kinds of stories, you can't rely on one type of source. So you really have to look out there, cast your net really, really widely. But then also keep in mind that whatever sources you do find have their own limitations, right? And when you're researching the lives of enslaved and formerly enslaved people in particular, most of those sources that you find or going to find were created by people with a vested interest in keeping those people enslaved or oppressed, right? So the perspective that they give on the lives of enslaved and formerly enslaved people are often skewed
or biased in a particular way. So you also have to be able to read and understand the sources that you're dealing with, so that when you're writing the story, you don't replicate those kind of oppressive, biased narratives that you often find in the record.
And you write about a problem with imagination, that writers of history either have too much of it or not enough of it. So rumor and supposition versus what you call disciplined imagination. Is disciplined imagination the same thing as artistic license?
No, I don't think it is. Disciplined imagination is a term that was used by a historian called named Paula Fass, who's a cultural historian, who, you know, basically says, look, we have these sources that are very imperfect and that are very limited in allowing us to tell the stories that we want to tell. So what you have to be able to do is to try to use your imagination to think about, you know, in the case of Caroline, we have a lot of court documents that portray her in particular ways, right? The prosecution is trying to portray her as this evil person that has to be dealt with. And the defense, of course, is trying to persuade the judge that she's innocent. And so they sort of go to the other extreme in portraying her as almost kind of like a childlike, you know, completely innocent, incapable of sort of independent thought, almost. So the real Caroline falls somewhere in between, and what a disciplined imagination is to try to imagine, well, how might a person who's being portrayed in this way, who's being accused of murdering a child, whose life is on the line, how might they react, right? What can we imagine their reactions to be? What can we imagine their perception of what was happening to them was like? And we have to try to reimagine what the story might be from their perspective. So it's a disciplined imagination is based upon the historical record. It's based upon the facts that you know to be true, you know, when something happened, what the outcome of the case was, so on and so forth. But you just push a little further and you ask questions that you might not be able to answer definitively, but through the process of asking them, it leads you to pull other things together and to try to reimagine what her perspective and what her experience of this particular event might have been.
Well, in the article about Caroline, which, by the way, can be found on the facts and information page on our site, esweku.org, in that article, you note that the very call to find more sources about people who left few, if any, of their own, reproduces the same erasures and silences that they experienced in their own lives. That seems like quite an irony.
It is, because, I mean, what historians, what we're trained to do is to rely on the archive, right? And when you have a question and you don't know the answer, you go and you find more sources, right? But when you're doing the history of enslaved and formerly enslaved people, where the only sources you're ever going to find are going to be produced by the people, like I said, who had a vested interest in making sure these people remained enslaved or remained subjugated after, you know, in Caroline's case, after slavery was officially over, you're not going to find that perfect source. Right. You're not going to find, you know, at some point, you know, a document that was produced by Caroline herself that tells us exactly what she thought or felt. So, again, you have to read the sources that you have with a very critical eye. But you also have to realize that you're never going to find the more sources to help you tell a story. So that's where the disciplined imagination comes in, is you have to try to flip it in some ways, right? So one way I did this was to think about, you know, the geography of Louisville, which was where Caroline was living and was being held in jail and when her trial took place, and to think about, you know, once she is found not guilty and she's released from jail, you know, what happens to her after that? I mean, that's where her official record ends. We lose track of her after that. But what might she have done? Where in the city did she actually place her feet, you know, once she walked out of the jail? What did she see around her? What was going on around her? What options were open and available to her in terms of where is she going to go? Where is she going to live? Who's going to support her? Where is she going to find work? These kinds of things. And just sort of expand our understanding of what the archive is. Now, some historians might say, well, once she walks out of jail, we don't know what happened to her. We can't know that's the end of her story. But for historians like me, who, you know, we refuse to stop there. We might not be able to, quote unquote, know without a doubt what happened to her, but we can imagine, right? We can imagine what possibilities were available to her, what different paths she might have taken, and how her life might have progressed from that point forward.
Carol, we're experiencing something of a national reckoning right now over racial justice in this country. And there seems to be increasing interest in discovering what exactly happened back in the era of enslavement and then the Jim Crow period. As people turn to history to better comprehend and to form their opinions today, what is your advice to them?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, my general advice to anyone is going to be to read widely, right? Be careful, be attuned to the kind of things that you are reading, and in particular, read books and articles and things that are written by African-American historians who have been working on this really longer than any of us. They've been working on this, you know, going all the way back to the 19th century. You can find histories written by a former slave called William Wells Brown, you know, and the slave narratives by Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs and people like that, that give you firsthand accounts of what it was like to be enslaved and to try to escape from that situation. So make sure that you're reading widely. Make sure you have diversity represented in who you're reading and the kinds of things that you're reading. And realize that, you know, we've been dealing with this as a nation for a very long time. And it takes a lot of work and some dedication to try to work through the layers of mythology and misinformation that have been built up around slavery and the history of slavery in this country. You know, when I teach my classes on the Old South or the Civil War, I have to spend at least a third or half of the semester unteaching students. And these are students from New York. These aren't students who have been really, really steeped in the history of slavery and sort of the Lost Cause and things like that. In other parts of the country, these are students who probably think of themselves as pretty enlightened and pretty well educated, but I still have to spend a considerable amount of time each semester unteaching, right, some of these things that have become such a part of American culture. Ideas that, you know, slavery wasn't really that bad. A lot of slaveholders were really, really kind and looked after their servants. And I'm using finger quotes. You can't see me when I say servants. You know, enslaved people were really loyal and content, and after slavery was gone, they were really sort of unhappy and dissatisfied. You would be amazed how much those ideas have made their way into American culture far outside the South, and that's what I have to spend a lot of my time in the classroom is sort of unteaching before I can actually get to, okay, let's look and see what actually did happen, what some of these experiences were like.
Carol Emberton is Associate Professor of History at the University of Buffalo. She is a Register of the Kentucky Historical Society author whose article appeared in a special issue of the Register on the Civil War Governors of Kentucky Digital Documentary Edition. Thanks so much, Carol.
Thanks, Tom.
Fenton Johnson is the Kentucky-born author of 7 books, including 3 acclaimed novels. His newest book, At the Center of All Beauty, Solitude in the Creative Life, is getting a lot of attention during this year of lockdowns and social distancing. Johnson, a self-described solitary, mixes memoir, biography, and essay into a beautifully written exploration of the often misunderstood concept of solitude and its role in creativity. I'm happy today to be speaking with Fenton Johnson from Tucson, where he is the retired professor of creative writing at the University of Arizona. Fenton, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
Great to have you with us. You write about that solitude is often confused with loneliness. What's the difference?
Well, the last chapter of the book is called From Loneliness to Solitude. For one thing, people who call themselves solitaries, I borrow that word from the Trappist monk Thomas Merton, who used it the same reason that I do, which is the word single, which is what we often use, commonly use, has no meaning outside of marriage. And solitary is something entirely different. I should say that solitaries are often very social people, as Merton himself was, and as I am. Loneliness, we don't like to believe this, but loneliness is an invention of capitalism. The word lonely prior to 1800 is used to mean something closer to what I mean in solitude, something, a noble, exalting place from which one can look at the world and nature. Wordsworth's, I wandered lonely as a cloud. You know, he's comparing being lonely to this beautiful, floating, independent phenomenon. Then industrial capitalism comes along, and the people are forced from the countrysides into the cities. And the alienation that arises produces a phenomenon that we in English call loneliness. It's interesting to note that the word loneliness is almost unique to English. The Dalai Lama had to have it explained to him. French, which I speak pretty fluently, has no equivalent for it, nor does Italian. They have only solitude, which is, you know, which I use to mean that place of deliberately choosing to be alone in order to explore your own thoughts, the beauty of the world, your relationship to the infinite, however it is you define that, all of those grow out of solitude.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Thomas Merton. I should say you grew up in Nelson County near the Abbey of Gethsemane and knew Merton as a child. How did the monks at the Abbey kind of affect your thoughts about solitude?
Well, of course, first and foremost, they gave me a model of that, and a model that I'm very sorry to say has significantly disappeared from the landscape, you know, with full acknowledgement of the terrible abuses that happened. I don't think we can talk about institutionalized religion today without acknowledging the sexual abuse scandals. Nonetheless, in my personal experience, the presence of the monks nearby was a very positive thing. They were an injection of culture and of learning, and of also the understanding that silence was a very important way of interacting with the world. They were men. This was a Trappist monastery of all men. They were men who had committed themselves to the search for and the celebration of beauty. And that was an extraordinary influence. My mother, who was, and father, both of whom were in their different ways, as I explore in this book, at the center of all beauty, themselves committed to beauty. I think that was the basis of their developing a very close relationship with the monks across my childhood years. And you mentioned that I have seven books. It says something about the monks' influence on my thinking and life that in six of those seven books, monks play a significant role, either literally in my return visits to and stays at and investigations of the monastery and monasticism, or fictionally as characters in the novels.
Hmm. You mentioned your parents, and you said that, you know, even though they were a married couple, they were both in their own ways solitaries, that they spent, you know, time alone doing their own things, despite having a very large family.
Yeah, I mean, someone once said of writers, two writers, you ought to be able to learn something from your writing if you don't, it's not likely that anybody else will. And one of the revelations of this book to me was that one of my sources for an interest in solitude and a practice of solitude was my parents, whom I think had a, you know, my judgment, a pretty healthy marriage and a pretty, I won't use the word happy, I'll use the word content, which I think is a better word, marriage, but who organically spent large amounts of the day and their time alone. They had different projects. My mother was founded the library in my little town, New Haven, in southern Nelson County. My father was involved in community events, but also, as I describe in the book, increasingly as he grew older, gave himself over to building this cabin in a very remote part of Grayson County near Rough River Reservoir. And they spent long stretches of time alone. In my imagination, the ideal relationship is that of parallel lives, where you have two people who enjoy their time alone, have separate lives, and then come back together and have the pleasure of show and tell. That was, you know, in the most profound relationship in my life with my partner who died of AIDS in 1990, that was the nature of our relationship. It was very satisfying, you know, that you do your thing, I do my thing, and then we get together in the evening and we compare notes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the ways you explore solitude in the book is through profiles of a number of famous solitaries, and, you know, people like Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, Nina Simone, Eudora Welty, you know, even the street fashion photographer for the New York Times. What did you learn from studying their lives and work?
Well, you know, one of the hardest aspects of writing the book was there are so many people whom I call solitaires whom I could have written about, some who present themselves more logically than others because, you know, of course, everybody immediately thinks, oh, gee, solitary, somebody who lived alone their whole life. Zora Neale Hurston was married, four times,
mm-hmm.
Spent more time getting herself, extricating herself from her marriages than she actually spent in the marriages themselves. Cezanne was married, a very stormy relationship, married after 17 years, you know, lived alone for the last 7 years of his life, saw his wife and son one afternoon a week, but otherwise was painting alone. Each of these people, these solitaries in my profile, and whom I use as kind of inspiration for my own thinking about the subject, has a different approach to solitude and solitaries. In the end, I wanted a wide spectrum. I wanted people from the 19th century. I wanted contemporary people. I wanted surprising people. You know, who knew that, you know, Rod McEwen, the poet that critics love to hate in the 1960s and 1970s and 1980s, had very productive relationships with Frank Sinatra, with Nina Simone, with Dolly Parton. I want my books, each of my books, to be a kind of revelation for the reader. And looking at these people's lives was certainly a revelation to me. And I like to try to share that with the reader. I hope that that's what the reader comes away with the book, from the book with.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, this is a year when a lot of us are spending a lot more time alone than we have in a long time and really would like to. But so how can people, though, take advantage of this kind of time alone to cultivate a healthy solitude?
Well, you ask a very good question. It's certainly true that I think people who aren't in the book publishing world or the arts world think that there is an intrinsic value in the success of a particular work. Often the success of a particular work is a matter of timing.
Yeah.
And this book certainly came, you know, a book on solitude certainly came out at the right moment. And I've had many emails from people who have read the book who report as much to me. This is an extraordinarily difficult time, and I guess the first thing I would say
is to caution anybody about judging her or his reaction to an enforced being alone, to evaluate one's own sense of how to be alone from this particular moment, because this moment is so fraught with stress of every conceivable kind that is coming from the outside. Having said that, I would say that a key to any approach to solitude is, first of all, to be very forgiving of yourself. There is a great lesson that solitude can teach. Secondly, like any discipline or practice, whether it is athletic or artistic or whatever it might happen to be, spiritual, don't come to your experience of solitude and after 4 days, you're climbing the walls and you say, I'm absolutely not meant to be this kind of person. Give yourself some time and also try to find some structure. Read people who are, you know, any one of the people that I profile in the book can be a great teacher. You know, looking at the late paintings of Cezanne is very inspiring, and in sense of here's somebody who's really transforming solitude into beauty, you know, into a gesture of beauty. And try to find, you know, Merton has a lot of writing about solitude that is really good. James Baldwin, you know, one of our great thinkers. Mm-hmm. I almost had a chapter on James Baldwin, classic solitary. And his writing is, you know, fiery and passionate and necessary at this particular historical moment, and also is shot through with a vein of solitude. Wendell Berry has some great essays about solitude, an essay called An Entrance to the Woods. Carson McCullers, I mean, a lot of the Southern writers, Eudora Welty, whom I profile in this book. Studying those people and seeing what you can learn from them. And I'd like to think that that this book, At the Center of All Beauty, is a kind of primer or you know, a map, a guide for someone thinking about solitude.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Fenton Johnson, the author of At the Center of All Beauty, Solitude and the Creative Life. Thank you. We enjoyed having you today.
Thank you for having me.
Tom Eblin reviews Kentucky-born or based authors in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning and the online cultural affairs magazine, Undermain. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.